Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Latin America Review Live, the live streams we do every week. And today we're going to be talking about Bolivia and some wave of right-wing protests that have turned extremely violent, constricted to one city, which is the city of Santa Cruz. And just in the last hour, I mean, we'd planned this for a few days now to be a sort of general discussion about you know, the right-wing groups in the city of Santa Cruz who as well participated in the coup in 2019. But in the last hour, the situation has got dramatically worse. Camila, I think there's, could we go through some of the events that have happened in the past couple of hours in terms of the violent attacks that are being carried out still right now by these far-right groups in the city of Santa Cruz?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was just going to post the link. I didn't get a chance to do that yet. Do you want to let me do that really quick? Or
yeah, absolutely. So essentially, we touched on this in our last, in the live stream last week. We were talking about how there's been somewhat of a conflict coming out in the past few weeks in Bolivia over the issue of the national census. And that might, the government had proposed that it take place in 2024. The right-wing groups in Santa Cruz, including the governor of Santa Cruz, Fernando Camacho, some people may remember him from the days of the 2019 coup. He says he wants it done a year earlier, and he basically ordered a bosses lockout in the city of Santa Cruz against the government. And from there, a number of violent protests have been springing up from these groups allied to the governor, Fernando Camacho. And just in the past couple of hours, what we've seen is those groups have burnt down the headquarters of the Campesino Indigenous Campesino Union Federation, of the Workers Federation, the Central Obrera Departamental, numerous government institutions, including the National Institute of Statistics, including National Office for Land and for Forestry, and a number of other public buildings. It is very reminiscent of the 2019 coup. The good news is that this is very restricted to one city. It's not something that's taking place across the whole country. It's very much a regionalist dispute, and I would argue a separatist dispute as well from the city, Santa Cruz, involving Fernando Camacho. But anyway, to talk about this, we are with our good friend, Catherine Lederberg from Andean Information Network. Is a human rights and analysis organization that's been working in Bolivia since 1992. And we're just going to bring her up here one sec. Hi, Catherine, how's it going? Could you give us maybe a bit of a rundown of some of the violence that's been taking place in the past couple of hours? Who's involved exactly? Who are the targets? What's going on?
Thanks so much, Ali and Camila. It's been a really bad day in Santa Cruz. The people who are bearing the brunt of this are the low-income people in Santa Cruz, largely indigenous people, migrants from other regions, people who are not allied with what is a very elitist, top-down, undemocratic group, the Comité Cívico. The Civic Committee, please remember that Luis Fernando Camacho was head of this Civic Committee. Now he's governor of Santa Cruz. And that this group is closely linked to an illegal parastate group, that committed a great deal of violence during the coup, that the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, the United Nations and the international community have asked to be disbanded. Unfortunately, this never happened. The Libyan government didn't take these actions. And what we're seeing now is things are spiraling out of control. It's centralized in the Santa Cruz department and based on ostensibly a demand for the census. But if we look at it, very similar to what happened in the coup, this violent parastate group backed and paid for by the Civic Committee and backed by the governor of the department just burnt down and just totally sacked the internet, the National Statistics Institute, the organism that's supposed to carry out the census. So obviously, the goal of a census was just more a means to destabilization than an end. And what we've seen is that this violent group that has over 5,000 members, that is funded by the Civic Committee and by wealthy Santa Cruz elites, has gathered in the city. There are groups coming from as far away as Montero, as far and other regions that in advance moved into urban Santa Cruz, armed with clubs, very similar to the youth resistance in Cochabamba during the coup, another illegal group that still is active. Yet we've seen no prosecution of the Unión Juvenil Cucinista, an organization that shows a very fascist formation, uses the Nazi salute, and they really went out in mass today, first to surround and burn down the Campesino, the Indigenous People's Workers Union, then the Central Labor Union. They were very well organized surrounding these installations, surrounding the Bolivian National TV station. Four reporters from the Bolivian National TV station were attacked physically, and the violence is continuing to spiral with the backing of these elites and with very little response from the central government. It seems pretty clear now that the police commander in Santa Cruz is working with this illegal strike and along with the elites and along with the youth union. And I am very, very concerned about what will happen tonight, because the Santa Cruz Youth League and these 5,000 thugs that are circulating around the city tend to operate more freely at night. So you have very little state presence. You have institutions that depend on the departmental government that are supporting these violent actions. And so far, we've heard very little from the international community. On the one hand, they're just getting up to date, and we're hoping that some institutions will say something soon. But tonight is crucial, and we're really living this very undemocratic period of extreme violence, racist violence that occurred in the coup. And it really points to the error on the part of the Arce administration of not prosecuting this illegal group and disbanding it as the international community requested, but at the same time not pressing charges against the governor of Santa Cruz, who was at that time the head of the Civic Committee, who openly in front of a television camera admitted that his father had paid off the police and the military to rebel. It was a clear admission of guilt and something that's extremely illegal. So far, he has faced no legal consequences. We have this corrosive impunity here that is leading to this generalized violence where low-income cruceños are really bearing the brunt, and they don't seem to be receiving any protection from the state. And I'm very, very concerned about what could happen in this department, one of the wealthiest departments, and one that has in the past threatened to actually secede from Bolivia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to say to people coming in to the stream now, if you've got a question for either Catherine or ourselves, you can put it in the chat. I'll be watching the chat throughout, so you can put your questions there. I'll read it out. But Catherine, you mentioned the failure to prosecute some of these groups, and there was even a recommendation with an international report that HIEI a year ago recommended that they disband these groups. That hasn't happened. They continue to organize very freely. I mean, do you think a part of the inaction on the part of the state or the soft approach from the part of the state towards these violent groups perhaps does that have to do with the fact that if someone was to be arrested right now for burning down a public building, which in every country of the world, as far as I know, is illegal, that you'd have Human Rights Watch and all these other sort of State Department aligned organizations talking about how the Bolivian government is turning authoritarian and you know, we condemn this, etc. Do you think that plays a role here?
Well, Well, I think there's a clear role with the right-wing press still promoting a false discourse with international funding. Some funded, for example, Agencia Fides, funded by the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy. The head of the Press Association, funded by the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy for a very long time. State Department reports that have glossed over the truth, that haven't dealt with it. But it's really important to mention that at a crucial time in October of last year, even the U.S. Embassy, with support from the U.S. Congress, asked for these groups to be disbanded, as did the Committee Against Torture in the United Nations. So there was a point in time, and the HIE, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission report, came out a year and a half ago, where it was feasible and tangible to prosecute these groups. To, you know, you have the high leaders in Cochabamba on trial, but that trial is constantly postponed. In fact, one of the leaders of that group actually said they received funding from Rómulo Cabo, the Comité Cívico that's funding the Unión Juvenil Cruzanista. It was possible to do, and it was necessary to do. And the other thing that was necessary and that hasn't happened is the trying and legal consequences for key members of the security forces, both the armed forces and the police, that had a very close relationship or maintained relationships with these parastate groups. Impunity is corrosive, and you can't just forget about a coup, you know, without justice and without a focus on that. And let's face it, Bolivia's justice system is extremely weak. I think that this kind of renewed attempted coup, this renewed violence, and the lack of progress in the trials for the coup violence has really helped facilitate this process. Obviously, the right-wing press and the international community that supported the coup, and when I talk about the international community, I'm talking about wealthy northern nations, right? The European Union, the United States government, Canada, for example, there's going to be a splashback. But there needed to be, in the interim period, a lot of work done towards justice and disbanding those groups that simply didn't happen. I don't know if it was wishful thinking on the part of the Arce administration that these problems would just go away. But we see that these groups in Santa Cruz are more active than ever, better funded than ever, and that you have at least the police commander in Santa Cruz working actively with the right, according to reports that we've received. So it's a scary situation.
I was just posting the link because, you know, we're new to live streaming. So we want to make sure that people are able to watch and engage and ask questions if they'd like to. This is a really important topic that we're talking about right now. And, you know, of course, this month is reminiscent for all of us and everyone in Bolivia because of all of the things that took place in October and November 3 years ago. Every day this month is an anniversary of human rights abuses, of lots of different violations that took place. A lot of events took place here in La Paz and in other cities and areas of the country when this coup was unraveling. Of course, this is the day that Evo had to leave the country for Mexico in order to save his life. I believe that that is truly the reason he left. And I know that if he had stayed in the country, they would have tried to execute him, to assassinate him, for a paid amount of money. $50,000 is what they said. And I think one of the things that happened that is very important to highlight that I think got lost in much of what took place in November is the attacks on the press, the attacks on journalists who were covering what was going on during the coup. So it was very difficult to get information. A lot of what we saw was in WhatsApp messages, of course, on social media, but all of it was out of order, unorganized. People were being persecuted for their jobs. And there were attacks on Bolivia TV, on Patria Nueva, and all of these other outlets. That's happening right now in Santa Cruz. That's something that's being denounced right now. Today, there were attacks on personnel, on staff of Bolivia TV, who are our only sources of information on the ground, as well as some of these community radio stations. But of course, they might have less resources. And we're not in Santa Cruz. We're here in La Paz right now. So this is a situation of human rights, of the freedom of the press, of the ability for people like ourselves who report on the ground or just report and do our job from wherever we are to be able to get information for human rights organizations and defenders and other organizations generally to be able to get information on what is taking place in Santa Cruz right now. And because of the threats and the things that have taken place, what took place today was actually damage done, a broken TV network camera of Bolivia TV, also attacks on a woman worker of Bolivia TV, and other things have taken place in these 3 weeks of far-right protests and blockades. And now it's just increasing, making it even more difficult for us to know what is going on. So that's a very serious thing that needs to be denounced internationally. This is not something small. It's something extremely serious, very concerning. And it means that, you know, it's going to be very difficult if this continues in the coming hours for us to know what's going on. We're talking about a situation, as you guys have mentioned, in which 4 people at least have already lost their lives in what amounts to killings that we can attribute to the leaders of these far-right protests, either the followers of the Civic Committee, the followers of Luis Fernando Camacho, or whoever it may be. But they are deaths, and we're talking about hundreds of injuries, and a lot of things that are happening are unaccounted for. It's also been very difficult for us to cover things when I was there on the ground in Santa Cruz because of the threats of violence, and we know that people don't like being filmed. They don't want their identities or their names to be released. So sometimes we witness what's going on, and we're not able to share and tell it. So talk to us a little bit about that, and, you know, we are really waiting in the coming hours to see if any of these international human rights organizations, supposedly, or any of the embassies in this country, I mean, who is watching this? And is this a situation that people are going to respond to? It's completely absurd. These are the kind of things that happen in other countries in which the Canadian embassies or the State Department or Canada Global Affairs or whatever countries begin to release statements against the government of Nicaragua, against the government of Iran, of Venezuela, and other countries. It's happening here right now with very little international response or attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say, to add to that question, Catherine, like, we have a representative, for example, of Human Rights Watch in Brazil, seems obsessed with Bolivia. Do you think that anyone's going to be talking about this issue in that field? The violation of human rights, and it is a violation of human rights, burning down union buildings is absolutely a violation of human rights. It's putting, you know, people's lives at risk. It's taking away people's democratic spaces and organizations. So, like, do you think this is the sort of thing that, these groups or governments, embassies, like Camila said, are likely to pronounce themselves on?
Well, you know, one of the problems that we have here is there are very few organizations with a presence on the ground. You know, we have the High Commissioner for Human Rights Office. I do not know if they will make a statement. I think that the Inter-American Human Rights Commission will make a statement. I'm certainly sharing all the information and documentation I have with embassies and other organizations because, you know, either they make a statement and they speak out, or at least we know that they knew what was going on and that they chose not to make a statement. I think that people have not paid as much. I think that there are different issues that have been distracting this, like the elections or the situation for Peru, but we really need the international community to focus back on this. Because the other thing that we see, Ali and Camila, is that Bolivia and the coup was a test run or part of a recipe or a blueprint for fascist government takeovers that was attempted in Peru, that even, you know, was an attempt January 6th in the United States to have the same kind of coup denying election results. And Bolsonaro supporters attempted this just recently in the Brazilian election. So, you know, there are lessons to be learned from what happened in the coup and what is happening again now that has international implications and international implications for a fascist discourse and efforts that are frankly on the rise internationally. We have a fascist government now in Italy. We have a fascist discourse from Trump supporters in the United States. And yet a lack of recognition, for example, from the Biden administration of all the terrible things that happened. And another point that I wanted to make in terms of the lack of access and objective press coverage in Santa Cruz by the right-wing press, it's manipulative. There are some press outlets that have more access, and we don't have, as we did with the National coup, a national takeover. So you have some outlets like La Razón that's publishing more balanced information. But we have the same kind of dynamic in the coup, that publications or videos or documentation of human rights violations that are posted on Facebook simply disappear, or accounts are blocked. And on other social media, on Twitter, you know, an account that shows the documentation or an attempt to show human rights violations is blocked, and so that social media platforms are not necessarily safe to share this sensitive information. We don't, you know, it's very worrisome, just as it was in the coup, for people to walk around with cell phones in Santa Cruz with documentation of these human rights violations, because, you know, at best you lose your cell phone, and at worst you make yourself a target. And these are all concerns that are very present right now in Santa Cruz. And we're talking about Santa Cruz, where the great majority of the population's rights have been systematically violated for the past 3 weeks. And there's an escalation of that right now.
Absolutely. We're just going to read out some of the comments from those watching. We've got, first of all, Big Teal says, not sure the name of Camila's co-host. And my name is Oliver, at Ovarges52 on Twitter, if you want to look that up. But yeah, next got Arroyo Rivera, a grave situation. Everyone needs to urgently share this to their networks. Absolutely. Make sure to share. We've got, you know, as much information as possible on our Twitter at Causacho News. Please make sure to share that and this stream as well. Big Teal, yes, please stay safe, Causacho News. We're based in La Paz at the moment, and there is no kind of mobilization here in La Paz. There's no organizing by these right-wing groups on the streets here in La Paz. This is very localized to one region, which is Santa Cruz. There's been attempts to make this spread to other parts of the country. It hasn't really taken off. This is a regionless conflict, absolutely. I think we just lost our... Okay, we're going to keep reading. We're going to change camera for one moment while we fix the camera issue. Okay. Big Teal says, for me in the US, I see Biden as the liberal wing of the fascist US empire. They're all about war and blocking the most reactionary violent in many nations around the world. An unknown name says, Western social media should be designated a weapon of mass destruction. WhatsApp, Twitter, Instagram, all effective tools of American imperialism, as if they didn't have enough vicious tools at their disposal. Hey, Catherine, this is an issue really in terms of the amount of disinformation as well that we get on social media that incites a lot of the violence that we're now seeing from these right-wing groups.
Yeah, this is something that was part of the coup. Remember that, you know, there were key revelations published in the Washington Post, certainly not a left-wing publication, of fake Facebook accounts, for example, that were run by a U.S. consulting company, CLS Strategies, when their senior advisor for Latin America was a former Obama official, and then he was also briefly a Biden official. So what we're seeing again is that attempts to manipulate social media on the part of the right, and they seem to be clearly paid attempts, do have a lot of influence, you know, on the right-wing press, the external funding that they receive, and a false discourse. And we see things like that even on WhatsApp. Often pictures in the right-wing groups identifying grassroots and social movement leaders as drug traffickers or identifying them so that they can be targeted and beaten. And so, you know, social media is a useful tool, but it also is a vicious weapon. And when it can be bought, and it certainly has been in this case, it can be devastating.
Yeah, I've got another comment here saying, "Were Arroyo Rivera, was the Arce government not acting out of fear of mobilizing just this sort of violence from the right? And now that it is mobilized, what is likely to be the response or what should be the response?" And obviously, we can't speak to what the government is planning right now, but we can certainly say perhaps what people there in Santa Cruz want to happen. People there in Santa Cruz want an end to this sort of terror campaign. And I think that's the best way to put it. People want to see the leaders of these violent groups arrested. They want to see the gang members that are involved in this. And actually, a lot of these people who are protesting, they're not there because they're ideologically, you know, this or that. They're not there because they believe in Fernando Caracho. Some of the people there include street criminals who have been paid to attend, and people want, you know, they don't want to be held hostage in their own city by these sorts of people. And that's the demand that we hear all the time from people down the ground. But, you know, Catherine, what do you think in terms of immediate? You mentioned earlier that tonight is going to be crucial in terms of, you know, the situation on the ground. What would you like to see happen overnight to reestablish a sense of calm and order in Santa Cruz?
Well, I think you would have to see the police arrest some of the key leaders of this movement. And, you know, there have been some arrests. I think there were, as a last count, 7 arrests of the Unión Juvenil Cruzanista. But people on the ground and the social movements leaders and the grassroots feel abandoned and feel unprotected. And, you know, it's not just the violence, but it's also an inability to work or to move around the city freely. I mean, it's an insane situation when you have elites hiring thugs where you can't walk from one place to another, where you might get beaten while they ask for ID, while they search you. It's an insane situation, but people want protection. They want the ability to work. They want a state that protects them. And the RC government at this point in time, I'm not sure if they don't have the skills. Also, it's very important to understand that Santa Cruz is a very different place than La Paz. And you have to have a good understanding of the very unique dynamics there. And you have to have skills and negotiating skills. And a lot of those things have to happen. In all fairness, the RC government has tried to negotiate, but it's very hard when one side wants to provoke conflict, to look for conflict. And the message that they've received from the international community is, in the past, go for it. There needs to be a message, one, from the international community that the direct people responsible for this need to be tried and receive legal consequences. And two, that the right in Bolivia, if they want to make progress in Bolivia, need to engage positively, come up with a platform, and actually try to work to make a contribution to their country. Because we haven't seen that. We haven't seen that in Bolivian history. And we've seen that they have been allowed to act consistently since the election of Evo Morales in an abusive manner and with external support to try to overthrow the government, something that they successfully did in 2019. So the population needs to be safe. They need to be safe from groups with fascist orientations, with racist orientations. They need to not be afraid for being targeted for having dark skin or indigenous blood or looking indigenous or expressing a political opinion. And all of those things continue to be very much at risk in Santa Cruz. And we need to have international voices really condemning this.
Yeah. Anyone watching, just reminded that if you have any question or comment or comments, you can put them in the chat. I'll read them out. But you know, the issue that they claim to be mobilizing about, the issue of a census. I mean, what is going on there? Because I don't think I've heard of any country around the world where there's been serious political conflict over a census. I think people often don't even know that it's happening until they get the actual forms or get a knock at the door to be, you know, to be asked questions for the census. It's not seen as a political issue in most countries around the world. So why do you think it has become that? Or is this simply an excuse to do this sort of violence that they've been waiting to do a long time? But like, why is this the issue that sparked this sort of regional conflict with one area of the country?
Well, I think that the key issue here is that, you know, a census takes place every 10 years. And the population has shifted, and probably the Santa Cruz department has a much greater population. Although the elites there and the people that follow them assume that population fully supports them, which isn't the case. But what they would like to do, and you know, the census was supposed to happen this year. That is true. But when you have an illegal coup, followed by a pandemic that overlaps, and continual attempts at destabilization on the part of the right, those kinds of activities that should be routine are disrupted. I think that's common sense. But what they want to happen is to have the census occur in 2022 or 2023, so that they will be able to demand redistricting. But then you get also into this very Donald Trump style of election denial, where there's a great possibility that they'll go back and say, look, the population distribution has changed. The 2020 election should be invalid. That's a motivation for conflict. Also understand that in the United States, something that's happened on the part of the right, which used to be the far right and is now just the right in general, is gerrymandering. Looking at the population distribution and redrawing electoral districts in their favor. So if you look at electoral districts in the United States, in many states, they're this bizarre shape which manipulates areas so that the far right can win in the vote. And we see that, we saw that in the midterm elections in the United States. So there's an effort, I think, also on the part of the right to be able to manipulate districts. And also it's important to understand that the census in their mind is a way to open a door to further fuel for conflict. So the far right in the past has disputed questions about indigenous self-identification. Remember, Bolivia has the largest indigenous population in South America. And it's something that these extremely racist elites would like to erase from the discourse and to make these peoples invisible. So there is a whole series of issues that can stem. It's not as if they just do the census, this will solve the problem. No, there's a whole nother series of conflicts that stem from this. And I don't think the census will solve the problem. And I don't think, though, that the census is a key issue in terms of objective representation of the Bolivian population. I think they're after something else.
So I just wanted to go back a little bit. I know we have some people who weren't here at the very beginning, but I just want to talk a little bit more specifically about the type of human rights violations that we are seeing in Santa Cruz, because we have referred to what's going on for the last 21 days largely as confrontations. There have been confrontations that have taken place at the roadblocks that are being held by the supporters of the Santa Cruz Civic Committee or the members itself, the supporters of Luis Fernando Camacho, the governor of Santa Cruz, and other shock groups such as the UJC. And of course, in the mornings, when the markets normally open, when people want to go out and begin the economic activity, their labor of the day, is when a lot of the confrontations have taken place. On many days, you know, just kind of this pre-dawn groups going head to head, both people who are, you know, residents that are very strongly against this paro, this lockout, and also the ones who are holding the blockades. So, you know, there's been those sorts of confrontations. But what's going on right now is by no means just confrontations anymore. It's very much one way. And it's really important to say that there is one side, which is, of course, these parastate groups that are aligned with Luis Fernando Camacho and the Golpista sectors of the country who were very much involved in the coup in 2019 and the destabilization that took place, who are now attacking those buildings, the buildings of, like we said, state institutions, of they're attacking the media workers and those union buildings as well, and other public property and private property as well. But specifically, some of the tactics that we've seen in recent days, not today specifically, but this week, and some of the deaths come from people who ran into these cables or wire lines that were strung across roads, and motorcyclists hit those. One of them died instantly. He had two other people on his motorcycle who were also injured. And another person, we saw really gory images of another patient at a hospital who had his neck cut and it was bloody. And it's important to say that we saw these same tactics used by the Guarimbas in Venezuela and also in Nicaragua in 2017 and 2018. This is no coincidence. And it's also nothing light. It's something that needs to be denounced. If it was the other way around, it would quickly be denounced by the people with huge platforms of the Bolivian right and all of the continental right that align with them, as they've made up false accusations of supposed mass aligned groups attacking the right in this country. There's no doubt about it that that's no longer a confrontation. When people who are working class, who have to, you know, drive people around in a motorcycle to do their jobs, when they have families on the back of their bikes and they can't go through certain ways and they're being injured just by driving. I mean, these are acts of terrorism. That's what they were referred to when they happen in other countries. And it needs to be referred to that here as well. Additionally, these groups that are holding the roadblocks in Santa Cruz are cutting off access to hospitals and emergency services and those centers that accept women who are victims of gender-based violence. And there has been instances of violation of women at these roadblocks. So it's very much one way. It's not simply confrontations. It is not just vandalism or just violence. I think we need to be very specific about what's taking place. And also, you know, there are patterns, a lot of repeated things that we saw back in at this time 3 years ago in 2019 when that coup was taking place. So these are very specific things that we're going to be able to cite later on, that we're going to be keeping track of. And it's nothing light. I think it's very, I think that there's we have to some extent become desensitized to some of this because we've seen so much violence from the Santa Cruz right time and time again. This is not the first time they tried to hold a lockdown. Obviously, the other ones or the one-day warnings that they did didn't last very long. They didn't get very far. But we've seen this repeatedly. And so I think it's very important that we draw attention to that.
Yeah, definitely. And we got a comment from an unknown name says, is the popular will there to confront this fascism? I assume there was, considering how much popular support there is to prosecute the Golpistas of 2019. And there is. I mean, there was a protest today in Santa Cruz calling for an end to the violence of these right-wing groups. And that got attacked by the paramilitary group Unión Juvenil Cruceñista. And there've been protests throughout this whole time, but it's wrong to say that the ordinary people should go out and confront these armed groups while the police don't do anything, while the actual authorities are not doing what they should be doing. Their job of the security forces is to maintain law and order. And, you know, I don't think it should be normal, you know, market traders, workers who should have gone out and risked their lives, you know, because you're risking your life when you go out against these sort of gang members that have guns, that have explosives. You know, they could, I think it's important for social movements to support the government if it does take action. But this failure to act on the part of the police creates even more confrontation. I mean, this is, I don't know, Catherine, it's surely something you've seen in terms of the lack of police presence, or then people have to take things into their own hands to get to work or etc. And then there is where a lot of violence and conflicts end up happening.
Yes, I think that's exactly the case. And we're not talking about grassroots groups with differences of opinions or having fistfights at roadblocks. We're talking about an illegal parastate group with considerable funding, with dynamite, with other explosives that are given motorcycles, allowed to transit freely, that pummel low-income people. So it would be a fair fight. And, you know, we've seen in previous strikes that they burned market posts, for example, low-income people that live day to day. We have cases of, as Camila said, group rapes at blockades, and then attacks on women organizations that attempt to provide services for them. So no, you don't have, as an average Santa Cruz citizen, and the great majority of Santa Cruz citizens are suffering from this, you don't have protection from the police. There's no 911 you can call. You can't get to work. You can't make a living if you're attacked or you're sick because they aren't letting ambulances through the blockades, or you're hurt. You don't necessarily have access to medical attention. You don't have access to basic services in many cases. And so, you know, this idea that an illegal parastate group manipulated by elites and a coup leader can lay siege to a city, and this is what happened during the coup, is inadmissible, unforgivable, and completely illegitimate. And I think we need to see it that way. And so there have been people that have attempted to resist, but there are still people and social movement leaders who are facing charges, trumped up charges from the coup. And so this lingering impunity is really making this extreme far right, you know, and fascist focused violence possible.
Yeah, we got a question from Urban Campesino. He says, do we know whether US-funded NGOs such as Rios de Pie are involved again? And yeah, Catherine, what have you seen in terms of some of these sort of shady groups once again trying to latch onto this issue? Have we seen much of that?
Well, Rios de Pie, I saw a string of tweets that were put out that were quite sloppy. It seems like their budget has somewhat waned. Their lack of respect for the truth and their political focus continues to be the same. They're largely funded by the Human Rights Foundation, something that's run by Venezuelan far-right exiles. Also see, Adita, what was the dynamic in the coup is supposedly human rights organizations and justice organizations that were funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, were also funded by the European Union, didn't denounce the coup. And we're seeing that same dynamic here, except for in the case of the one woman that was raped. The rest of the violence, the parastate groups, they've never denounced them. They continue to not denounce them, and they continue to receive international funding. And so what you have is a human rights presence that should be well funded in the country, but that is mute, or that, and that is tacitly supporting these abuses. And so there's the perception, although there are some organizations that have been good at listening to the few voices that have the ability to reach the international community, you have this continued dynamic of covering up or a permissive behavior. Because, you know, clearly if you're a well-intentioned government and you're funding an organization that doesn't speak out about violations, you stop funding them. And that has not happened.
Yeah. I've got another comment. Lauren Ginniger, I think that's it. These are definitely guarimbas, and just as in Venezuela, it's a mistake to go soft on these violent ultra-rightist thugs. And Camila, you spent some time in Venezuela. Would you compare this tactics to the culture of some of the Venezuelan right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every time someone comes into my messages, a friend, a comrade, a colleague from one of these countries that has experienced such high levels of right-wing violence, of course, in Venezuela, it took place largely in one neighborhood only of Caracas, of the capital. It took place in the Chacao and Alameda neighborhoods, which is really just an upper middle class area where the right wing was organizing, and they were paying people, street kids who were definitely a lot of people who don't have means, who are already addicted to alcohol or substances, and they were feeding them drugs, meth specifically, amphetamine specifically. They were paying them some amount of cash. This is the far right party, Voluntad Popular, and the leaders of that organization. That's, of course, the party of Juan Guaido, but there were other leaders at the time that were doing the organizing on the ground. And they were getting these kids to, over time, sustain that mobilization. Because as I've said here before, a lot of the people who vote for Luis Fernando Camacho in Santa Cruz, sort of middle class, upper middle class people in Santa Cruz, they're not going to be that committed, such as the base, the militants of the MAS, to go out and hold these roadblocks every day. And they are paying drunks and kind of street people and people who will just do anything, common criminals, to hold these blockades. And so that's something that we saw take place in Venezuela. And sorry?
I'm having some problems with the camera. Should we change to webcam?
No, I think it's fine.
Okay, it's freezing. Connection's not great.
Okay, well, maybe we have too many things going on here. But so we saw the same type of thing taking place in Venezuela, and there were a lot of calls because of all of the crimes that were committed to just regular residents trying to get to work. There were a lot of injuries, a lot of people who were targeted on mere suspicion of being Chavista in that country. And people wanted justice. They wanted the government to go after the actors who were carrying out this violence on the streets. From the exterior, it was painted in the international media that was aligned with and working with, collaborating with the...
I'm going to change camera because it's frozen.
Okay. Well, we have a frozen camera, so we're changing it for a moment.
It's an issue with connection.
I lost my train of thought here, but the international media at that time in Venezuela, and now I'm talking about 2017, beginning around April of 2017, we had the media, specifically the major outlets and agencies such as Reuters, FA, AFP, and the major newspapers, legacy newspapers of the United States, and even outlets from overseas, they were doing coverage, you know, largely in communication with and collaborating with the actors who were financing and backing this violence. We see the same thing taking place here. We know that when there are certain actions by the Santa Cruz Civic Committee, by the far right in Santa Cruz, that they call their media people when they want those big networks like El Deber or any of the other TV stations there to come down and follow them to shoot from a certain angle, to put out a certain headline. And when you see the headlines, you see that they very much completely are telling a different story from other media outlets, such as the community radio stations, such as the state media. And so, you know, it can be very confusing because those right-wing outlets here in Bolivia are receiving a lot of reach internationally. Unfortunately, they have massive resources. And if you're using search engines or social media, it's very easy to find that kind of coverage. It's causing great confusion. Unfortunately, it's been a very long road, both in Venezuela and Nicaragua, for those governments and their institutions to go after the people who perpetrated these crimes against the regular working class people and residents who just wanted to go out and work and live their lives. And at what end were these acts of violence committed? Of course, it was all in an attempt to destabilize the country and pave way for a coup. They were both unsuccessful. But unfortunately, even when these plots to try to overturn the government, to try to create chaos in a particular place in a country, even when they're unsuccessful, they cause a lot of harm, not only to the economy, but also to individuals. There are a lot of people who are injured. There are a lot of victims of this crime. And that's exactly what's going to happen here, even if they're unsuccessful in doing what they're trying to do.
Yeah, definitely. We got a comment, Erfko, saying, where's the authorities in this? What's going on here? We did touch on this already, you know, in depth, if you want to go back to that. But we did comment on how there is an absence of the state. That's what people in Santa Cruz are saying. And the unions, workers' unions, just come out to say that they want a state of exception declared by the government so that real action can be taken. But yeah, I think we've covered most of the bases here. And, you know, we want to thank Catherine for being with us. It's been a long stream now, gone nearly an hour. And thanks to everyone who's been watching. Camila, I think you had one more question. Yeah, I'm just going to...
Hopefully we get better connections. So there's so much going on here, but we're having... not the best internet, Catherine, but what we would like to ask you is, of course, what took place today related to the 2019 coup is all of the sort of drama and the distrust surrounding Luis Almagro, another Luis. This is, of course, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States. A lot of people have called him illegitimate, and they have said that he cannot continue to be the head of this organization. So, you know, ever since the things that took place here in Bolivia with the report that was put out by the OAS, a lot of people said that this was, of course, a leading factor in the coup and all the events that took place. Now, a vote was just taken on a resolution at the Organization of American States Permanent Council just before we came on. So can you tell us a little bit about this probe that's going to take place surrounding Luis Almagro and his private life?
Of course, Camila. You know, this is something where there's been a series of denunciations, but very few people were willing to speak out about it. One is the false fraud narrative. But in this particular case, what allowed even the United States to vote in favor were the revelations of a long-term relationship with a staffer who received promotions because of her relationship with Almagro, something that was very well documented. And so you have a case where one of the first times there'll be an external investigation. You know, there are internal control mechanisms within the Organization of American States, but those have been co-opted by Almagro. So for the first time, they're going to have an external investigation of allegations about this relationship and the impropriety, which is clearly documented, but also of the abuse of a housekeeper and her inappropriate firing in Almagro's house, and perhaps a broadening, although it's not in the specific terms of reference, to other illegal and inappropriate acts that Almagro has promoted, such as the firing of Paulo Abrao, the head of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, largely fired because he came to Bolivia during the coup because they had a preliminary report and called it a coup, and because the Hye happened. There are other inappropriate firings based on accusations made by Marco Rubio that the Administrative Council has voted as inappropriate behavior in violation of the jurisdiction. So, you know, that external audit is moving forward. The same thing happened with Mauricio Clavert Caroni. Don't forget, Camila, that he's the person that spearheaded the U.S. efforts to support the 2019 coup when he worked at the National Security Council under Trump. And then he was made head of the Inter-American Development Bank, and he was fired after an external audit for the very same reason. At the same time, you know, this audit could take a long time. But at the same time, what we know is now with the electoral victory of Lula da Silva in Brazil, that and the shift to the left of Latin American governments, that with the progressive governments in Latin America, there's only one more vote needed to fire Almagro once Lula's ambassador makes it to the OAS. And this means that the English-speaking, largely English-speaking, although they speak other languages as well, Caribbean countries will be key. And if one Caribbean nation supports that, and with this kind of string of dominoes of proven allegations against Almagro, that's highly probable. So, you know, there's a good chance that early next year, Almagro will be out of there. And that would make him the first secretary general to be voted out by member countries, if that happens, if he's not forced to resign or fired because of this external audit. And I do think that's progress.
And do you think that this is something that Washington is essentially on board with at this point in their attempt to now rescue this organization now that it has been denounced multiple times, largely by these Caribbean governments that have spoken against it and have raised their eyebrows, have been very vocally critical about some of the ways in which they say that the Secretary General of this organization has operated unilaterally, that doesn't represent the whole of the region, the whole of the member states of the organization. Do you think that now that they have seen from Washington that there is so much opposition to this person remaining as head of the organization that they are already planning his ouster and have someone in mind, have something in mind to replace that, to try to continue this so that the OAS is just not, you know, in the coming time replaced by other organizations such as SELAC?
Well, I don't know. I sometimes think that the U.S. government and the administrations aren't as organized as we think they are, although it's clear that Almagro was their man. It's clear they threatened the Peruvians with expelling their ambassador if they didn't drop their candidate, and that they pushed for Almagro to go in. You know, just during the General Assembly in Lima, just a day before these allegations came out, you had the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, posing with Almagro, saying that they were working together and that he, not the OAS, but Almagro personally had their specific support, while Almagro was tweeting that he was going to defeat the patriarchy. An ironic kick in the teeth. It's interesting because the first time that the AP journalist that broke this story consulted the State Department, they said they would not support an external evaluation. As things continued to get worse and further denunciations came out, the U.S. in fact voted in favor of an external investigation because I think their hands were tied and they can see the writing on the wall. But it's also interesting that you can have, you know, the Biden administration that supported Trump initiatives, even when Trump tried to have a coup to impede their position. This slow learning or this inability to announce or to stick with allies in a kind of Cold War stance that aren't in their best interest is, I think, something that persists. But I think we will see if they develop a more pragmatic foreign policy, or we'll see if they get backed into a corner. And my guess is that the latter will happen for the first time in a long time, Camila.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Kirsten. Just before we close out, I'll just read a couple of comments that we got. Lauren Giniger saying, oh my God, welcome news. I hope we see Almagro unanimously shown the door. How gratifying. And David L says, we don't want the gloss of legitimately overthrowing Latin American states unsympathetic to the US be stained by impropriety. And yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously it's quite ironic that this is the issue that he gets brought down on. My knowledge on this is weak. I'm learning as the conversation unravels. That is definitely our aim with everything we do, is to spread awareness, especially for those who maybe don't know all of the background, all the context. That's what we try to do with this time. And we've gone on just an hour now, so I think we've covered the bases. Thank you so much, Catherine, for being with us.
And we just want to say, because we weren't able to put it on the screen, but you can find Catherine's work and Andean Information Network on Twitter at Andean Info Net.
It's in the comments.
I put it in the comments, and we'll be sure to tweet it out as well when we post a couple of clips of this. And I know Catherine has a lot to do. There's a lot going on in the country right now. We ourselves have a lot to catch up on, see what's going on. Want to remind everyone that you can support our work and become a subscriber of Causacha News and access all of our episodes of our weekly podcast, Latin America Review, on Patreon. We also posted that link, and I'll share that once again in the chat here.
Yeah, so thank you. Participated in the comments. Thank you to Catherine and Camila. And we'll be back next week with another stream, and of course with Latin America Review on Spotify and all other podcast platforms. So make sure to follow us there and subscribe as well, obviously, on YouTube. And so, yeah, thank you to everyone for participating.
Thank you.